The Big Picture, a Christian insight into the world of movies, television and pop culture with magazine editor Ben McKechin and scriptwriter Mark Hadley. A Bible Society Australia production, sharing the light of God's word into every corner of your world.
Bibbidi Bobbidi, I'm Ben McKechin.
And I'm his sock puppet, Mark Hadley. Welcome to episode 47 of The Big Picture for the week beginning February 21. And coming up on today's show, Ben watches people on their first dates, and it's not weird at all.
At all. And Mark witnesses the resurrection of Jesus through the eyes of someone who wants to prove it's a hoax.
Plus, Will Smith is back on the big screen, and Downton Abbey returns to the small for the last time. Accepting reruns, of course.
How sad I'm not. Mark, always a pleasure, never a chore.
That's not what you said off here.
I stand by my statements.
That's true, it's true. Mate, it's great to see you.
Oh, it's always good to see you. What's happening this week?
Well, this week, mate, we have fantastic things coming up. We've actually got my favourite segment ever. I'm doing an epic soundtrack mix next break to bust your mind. So I hope you actually stay around for that.
Okay, I better gather my mind right now to explain what else is happening around the traps this week. How to Be Single is at cinemas this week. I think after we talk about First Dates, which is coming up very, very soon in the show, this new Channel 7 show, we'll be talking a lot about this topic, about people single getting together. How to Be Single hits cinemas exactly the same time with Australian comedian Rebel Wilson in it and Fifty Shades of Grey's Dakota Johnson. But this is Being Single in New York. And judging by the trailer, this is a very potty mouth, sexed up comedy starring chicks. So if that sounds like your bag,
wow.
How to Be Single is at cinemas now.
Okay. Well, look, on the small screen, you might have thought that the big news this week was season 4 of Vikings kicking off Wednesday on SBS. But no, not for this little news hound, because on Monday, that's tomorrow, the TV spoof drama Unreal kicks off on SBS2. You might have heard of this, but basically it's about a reality TV show production where they go behind the scenes of this fictional series called Everlasting, a sort of a love interest thing, and reveal what TV producers are actually prepared to do in order to make their reality television real enough for the audience. Okay, so look, it should do for reality TV what Frontline did for the current affairs genre. I'm really looking forward to it.
Yeah, me too. Miss You Already is on DVD and Blu-rays, film starring Toni Collette and Drew Barrymore, so it's less How to Be Single, that kind of movie for the ladies. This one's more about BFFs dealing with everything from death to trying to have kids. I didn't really get into this movie. It was okay. But go back to the bit where it's a chick flick and it's not really for me. So Miss You Already is around and out there for the ladies.
And this coming Sunday, that's February 28th, and 1 week away from today, the 7 Network is launching its new digital channel, 76. 7 Flicks. Well, yeah, new material? No. More like 7 Mate for the other half of the family. Preview advertising is stacked with a mass of female-focused programs like Pitch Perfect, Pretty Women, and Grey's Anatomy, sliding down to the younger members of the family who might be interested in the Seinfeld if they haven't already bought the DVDs, and Despicable Me 2. If you'd like to watch TV eat itself yet again, tune in this Sunday for the launch.
Tune in next Sunday. This is the big news item for this week, Mark. Next Sunday night's program of The Big Picture is going to be all devoted to the Oscars, because when we're going to air is roughly the same time, America speaking, of when the Oscars is happening, but it's not going to be televised in Australia till the day after. So it's very timely for us to be talking about all things Oscars. So what we're going to do today, though, is something... Has this ever been done on radio before, Mark?
I don't know. What a sight gag.
if you can hear what we're doing.
Let me get my notes here.
That's right. What we're doing is sealing envelopes of our Oscar choices for next week. Our Oscar choice for all the big categories like Best Picture, Director, that sort of thing.
I have here the definitive list of who is going to win according to me.
And here's mine according to me.
And if they don't, I'd be bitterly disappointed.
We're locking that away. We're going to open them next week. We're going to open each other's and read out our suggestions and have a go at each other about how we've selected different things and how we both know we're actually going to win.
Plus heaps more Academy Awards sort of spoof and material and information and fun and reviews. So do join us for our Academy Awards show next week.
Okay, right now is true or false time, Mark, where I'm going to tell you something and you're going to tell me whether you think it's true or false.
False. Oh, sorry, start.
True.
Mate, false.
Okay, in 1989, when Fish Called Wanda was showing in theatres in Denmark, a Danish man, a Danish audiologist as it turns out, literally laughed himself to a stroke when he was watching the movie. I shouldn't be laughing at people's strokes. Is that true or false?
Sorry, I just died.
Don't do psych gags. Okay. Is that true or false? Hold that thought.
I will. An audiologist laughed himself into a stroke at a fish called Wanda.
In Denmark in 1989. We'll come back to that. Have a think about it. We'll come back to it after our What Your Kids Are Watching segment for this week, which is right now. Okay. So we should be doing that.
Stop doing that.
The sight gags and the pauses.
I was just thinking about Denmark. I was thinking, that's a funny place. How many times have you thought, what? Someone has made a TV show about that? I mean, really?
What?
Ready to have...
I think like every second day, I think that.
Are you ready to think it again?
Yes.
Channel 7's new reality show, First Date, says blind dates happen in front of cameras. Yes, they actually did that. Ben spectated on these televised dinners, wondering if he could learn anything at all about what single people are seeking for in Mr. and Ms. Right.
Do you believe in love? Love is, you know, it's everywhere.
I just don't think I've met that right person.
Are you a professed data blue?
Yes, I am.
They're all nervous.
Black snakes.
You got this.
Because they're about to go on a real first date.
What type of guy do you usually go for?
Probably nothing like you, to be honest.
Well, that couldn't have hurt much at all.
Not at all.
So that's pretty self-explanatory. You saw the ads to this new Channel 7 series, I know, because you were telling me all about it. You were watching the Australian Open, and you and your wife, Amy, just groaned constantly, which made me think that it would be perfect for you to review.
Thank you.
So with that level of anticipation, how was it?
I really liked it. And that no sarcasm in my tone. No, I'm as amazed as you are. Maybe the bar was so low.
No, I'm sorry. I was just thinking about Denmark. No, please go ahead.
Mate, I thought First Dates was actually a really entertaining, engaging, well put together, well thought through program.
You were literally going, don't do this to me in the production.
I know. And I was only going to watch like one, maybe two episodes. I watched four. I watched four. And it does do what we said at the start. It's real people going into this restaurant that's got cameras everywhere, and they're on their first date. It's about five or six per show. And you get to meet people beforehand separately. They're talking to the camera a bit about themselves, what they're looking for. Then they have their date. And then at the end of the show, the people from the date have to sit in front of the camera, and they get asked the same question every time. Would you go on a second date? Oh. And you have to answer in front of the other people, which is remarkably awkward for the viewer and for the person on screen. But I was amazed at how gripped and fascinated I was.
You were invested.
By this show. for a reality show that just sounds like it's going to be formulaic, and it's intended to make you squirm or mock people, I didn't find it was that. I found it was something else entirely.
Well, this is not just something for the pretty young things, even though it's got a big following amongst kids. There are older and younger people on the show. Was there a noticeable generation gap about how people dated or how
Yeah, there was. And I have to say, the older people that were on it, they were the more questionable and they were the dodgier than the younger ones. A lot of the older, and this is my word of warning, we picked it for What Your Kids Are Watching this week because especially teens, I think, are going to get into this. If they like The Bachelorette and those kind of shows, I think they'll be lining up for First Dates. But the older people on this show, the show gets an M rating. It's because there's some language and also there's a lot of sexual innuendo. But it turns up with the older people that are going on dates. People are over 50 and 60. The younger ones are actually remarkably restrained. And what I really liked, one of the things I really liked about the show is people talked a lot about wanting a partner for life, wanting to meet someone who they could seriously be in a relationship they could love. And that a lot of people, younger and then kind of into middle age, were talking about how they didn't want to keep doing what a lot of people around them are doing, which is just cycling through different partners, basically just for sex and nothing else. People were looking for something more substantial. Another great thing about this show, Mark, and there are plenty of them, I'm amazed.
I'm setting the DVR. Sorry, I'm distracted.
It's incredible. I actually have a list of things that are good about this show. But another one is that beforehand, however people are screened to go on this show, they must have to say what things they're looking for, what they're into, et cetera, et cetera. And then the people behind the show haven't matched opposites so that fireworks will go off and people will punch each other. Instead, it's more like a blind date that you were setting up with friends and you actually wanted them to get together. These are people who have got a lot of similarities, and they discover that as they go about their dates.
Somewhere out there, there's a producer who's going, no, but I just want them to be happy.
I'm amazed, too, that that's the case. But I think there is a producer out there who wants that for people.
Okay, well, were you able to spot a common thread among the people who were going on these televised dates? I mean, apart from the desire to have a free meal.
No, you have to pay for it.
Oh, that's the gosh, other, they like, even who, make you pay
who expected
for your
that?
National humiliation.
Who expected that? I think the common thread for me, this wasn't everybody, but I think a very prominent one was people want to be known by somebody else. They have this deep desire to go beyond just surface chemistry, which is a big part of the show, and the innuendo and the flirting and that sort of thing. It's in the show, but people can't hide that they want to be deeply known by somebody else, which just reminds me of God and his creation of us and how he's invested in us something whereby we want to, where love equals knowledge and a deep understanding of the other. And the Bible, throughout its pages, Old Testament and New, puts these two thoughts together a lot about love and knowledge, that you can't really love someone deeply, wholeheartedly, all-consumingly without knowing them. And first dates for me reminded me that's what people are seeking, whether they know it's been put in them by God or not, whether they know that it should actually be directing them back to a relationship with God or not. It can come out in many different ways, including on first dates on Channel 7, which remains for me the biggest surprise of 2016.
Well, it is February.
I'm blushing. I'm like a gushing girl here.
Okay, well, First Dates is every Wednesday night at 9 p.m. on Channel 7, or you can watch older episodes on Plus 7, like Ben, who is now working through the back catalogue. It's rated PG, although Ben says that some of the topics of dinner conversation and flickers of bad language could have earned it the M, probably the 9 p.m. slot too.
Now, Mark, before What Your Kids Are Watching, I put to you a question of whether this is true or false, whether this did actually happen. 1989, when a guy was watching Fish Called Wanda in Denmark, he literally laughed himself to a stroke.
Now, I think that has to be false. And the reason why I say this is because I am married to a half Danish person, and they are just too well planned to have a stroke in a cinema.
You are correct when you say it's false, but your reasoning is false.
Oh.
Because it was true. Sorry, what was true is that he laughed himself to death.
Oh!
This guy laughed himself to death. Well, there's a scene in the movie where the character Michael Palin plays, called Ken, gets chips shoved up his nose by Kevin Kline. So you're still laughing?
Yeah,
this Danish guy laughed himself to death in the cinema about that, because it reminded him of some family situation that he was in. This is what his son said later. A similar family situation. He found hysterical. He found it so funny. He laughed himself to death.
Yeah.
That's true or false for this week, Mark?
Okay. I'm floored.
Mate, what's coming up on the show?
Look, coming up on the show, we've got my epic drama mix. You've got to tune in and say, hang around for this and see how many you can pick from great films of the past. We're also going to be talking about that new epic, if you like, Risen, about the resurrection, and, of course, the end of Downton Abbey as we know it. Season 6, I Will Be Crying on Air.
Welcome back. Anyone who's listened to this program for any period of time knows that Mark comes off all nice and smiley, but basically he delights in torturing anyone who doesn't listen to soundtracks or scores 24/7, which basically boils down to me. Now, in previous editions, Mark's forced me on air to try to guess the themes of his personal favorites in science fiction shows and spy movies and TV comedies, even his favorite westerns he put forward. So, Mark, what humiliation this week, my friend, my mate, buddy, you got in store for me? We chuckle. Ahaha.
Epic dramas are underscored by epic dramatic themes.
Yes.
Okay? And so what I want to do is I want to play you and our beloved audience 10 great epic dramas. Now, we're going to move through at a rocketing pace here. So as soon as you know the answer, you tell me and we can move on. But let's face it, these are absolutely recognizable. No one will have any trouble getting 9 out of 10.
A Space Odyssey.
There you go.
It came out in 1968.
So you're one for one. Go for number two.
All right. Is that E.T.?
No.
What was it?
It was Gandhi. 1982.
Of course.
God, didn't you feel the subcontinent resonating through that one?
I did not, no.
Okay, go to number three. You'll be happier with number three.
The Godfather?
Yes. You seem much happier now. Two for three. So much happier, you're definitely going to get number four.
Oh, geez Louise, is that Titanic?
It is indeed. It's Titanic. You see, it's so much fun. You're having the time of your life here.
Okay. Number five.
At least I am.
There's a real pattern emerging with these where they're just very soaring and dramatic, and I cannot place this one.
If I gave you a hint and said World War II,
I would say Saving Private Ryan.
Yes, and you'd think it'd be that, wouldn't you? But it's actually Band of Brothers. But yeah, you know, that's it. It's fantastic. Here comes the giveaway. Here comes the giveaway.
Waiting for the giveaway. Get to the giveaway bit. Back to the Future.
There's an entire audience out there screaming at you. It's the Lord of the Rings.
Back to the Future.
There we go.
I reckon they've ripped off the Back to the Future score, and I'm going to stand by that.
There's not a chance.
Okay, number seven.
Go on.
Still lost for words. Mate, you get me on this thing time. You said it was going to be easier.
This is as epic as they come.
I evidently don't listen to enough music in movies. What's this?
It's Gone with the Wind.
Gone with the Wind?
Well, it's gone now.
Number eight.
Just think epic.
This isn't the same music?
They look epic.
I'm thinking epic. Gladiator?
No. Oh, gosh.
Ben-Hur?
The Last Emperor. 1987. The Last Emperor.
I've never seen it.
Oh, oi. Okay, you probably don't want to
look at that. Okay. This one for sure.
This one this time.
Oh, Mark, you promised it would be easier, and now I'm just scratching my head. I've got like three, haven't I? What's this one?
That's Lawrence of Arabia.
Oh,
are
that
you
old chestnut.
That whole
Who remembers the themes for Lawrence of Arabia? Okay, and finally, this one.
Now, this is possibly my favourite interpretation of this story and my most epic piece of music ever. Like, it's just brilliant. It featured in a Nescafe ad, for Pete's sake.
Wasn't this a beer ad as well?
It was a beer ad but do you know the film?
I should know the film, but I know the piece of music, but I'm struggling to remember what the movie was. No.
I'm going
to
give you some characters.
The Mission?
No, but, you know, kind of there. It had an old hoary character called Merlin.
The Sword and the Stone?
Well, no, that was a cartoon. But
okay, tell us.
Excalibur from 1981.
Of course. Mate, you said it was going to be easier. Next time, you're just going to have to do epics for dummies, like for this one over here. But I appreciate you bringing that to our attention,
audience,
I think.
The audience out there has just realized that they should be hosting. You know that.
Okay, let's move on from me. Well, we've got to put the music back on because I just wanted to relive the good times again. Mate, let's move on to the next part of the show because obviously I wasn't keeping up.
You can't believe you didn't get the Lord of the Rings.
Come on, man. I can't either. That's a little bit embarrassing over here. Let's move on to the first now showing choice for... good, then get past me. I don't think I'm going to recover. There are plenty of great books you might send your friends to if they had questions about the resurrection of Jesus, Mark, like John Dixon's A Spectator's Guide to Jesus or Frank Morrison's Who Moved the Stone? That's just to name a few. But are there many films? And the answer is a pretty short one. No, not many. Until now, the Hollywood biblical thriller Risen stars Joseph Fiennes as a Roman soldier looking for answers. And along the way, he does away with many of the key arguments that skeptics try to use to disprove the most amazing event in human history.
I served the Roman Empire. I fought wars against those who did not believe in our gods. But nothing could prepare me for the truth that has now risen.
He was very special.
They're fanatics.
What was his name?
He was called Yeshua.
The man's dead. His followers are in hiding.
He's been a threat.
take control out there and finish things.
The tomb is sealed, guarded with your life.
If this body vanishes,
we have a potential messiah.
Risen is being touted by its producers as Gladiator in tone and thriller in nature, and it certainly follows the trajectory of a classic mystery. Joseph Fiennes stars as the Tribune Clavius, a veteran centurion tasked with the job of avoiding a political crisis for Pontius Pilate. The battle-hardened soldier oversees Jesus' removal from the cross after the crucifixion and the safe sealing away into a tomb, and then lo and behold, all these rumours start emerging that the Nazarene is up and about and people are seeing him walking around. And so Clavius has to head out to put an end to this before, well, revolution that might spur on from the Jewish rabble, so to speak. And so he heads out with his trusty aide Lucius, played by Tom Felton, otherwise known as Malfoy, and comes in contact...
Apart from the Harry Potter movies, you mean? Yeah.
And comes in contact with bribed Roman guards, not-so-brave disciples, and one person he never expected to meet. It is an amazing story. It's great fun, but what's more...
It's quite an unusual story, too, and an unusual approach to what's... very famous event in history. But is this actually history, this different perspective, this different take?
The answer is yes and no, because it is based very solidly in the historical documents. So there's lots of material in there that's drawn straight from the Gospels. You know, were the Sanhedrin there trying to cover up rumours of Jesus' resurrection? Yes, they were. But historically speaking, there was no Clavius who was going around doing... He's the foil for the audience as they follow
the arguments. So completely fictional character, this Clavius that Joseph Fiennes plays.
But a very real situation that history records.
Yeah. Okay. So what's it like as a film? Because it sounds... I'm pretty tantalized by this movie. I'd have to say a lot of Christian films or so-called Christian films or faith-based films, whatever you want to call them, a lot of them have come through not really that interested in. They seem really mushy or treacly or very formulaic, just very expected. But this one, very intrigued by its premise.
Yeah, look, I personally found it a great surprise. Like, I really enjoyed it. It's actually quite clever in the way it's put together. It's believably acted. Joseph Fiennes is especially good, and Peter Firth, who plays Pilate, is great as well. It does a clever job too of dealing with the really skeptical arguments that are put up for Jesus' resurrection. So, like, the idea that Jesus only swooned and revived in the tomb is just shown for the ridiculousness that it is, or that the believers went to the wrong grave. Everyone knew which grave we were talking about. Of course, it was such a significant event. Or that the disciples stole Jesus' body just becomes the most ridiculous statement in terms of what was going on in the time. It really is a great sort of knockdown of that. It does lag a little towards the end because I think it has a little sort of a moment where it becomes very contemplative, and that goes on for maybe a tad longer than you might expect. But it is well worth the watch.
What do you think the filmmakers were intending with Risen? Like, who's it for? What are they trying to get across?
Look, I think that they were... I don't think they were just out to actually, say, proselytize, if you like. This is not a conversion pick. Okay, in fact, if anything, it actually lacks a little bit of the gospel. Okay, I mean, and
really, even though it's all about Jesus,
if the Christians were sitting down, then we would have at least said why Jesus rose. Okay,
doesn't turn up in Risen?
No, that's not the issue. But what I think the producers do have a go at is that this is a most incredible, historically asserted event. And we shouldn't really pretend that it didn't happen.
So would you like Bibles to now be sold with a free copy of Risen when it comes out in DVD and Blu-ray?
I think it's kind of the other way around, that Risen should be sold with a copy of the Bible thrown in. Because basically, Jesus is very silent in this film before, and I won't give any spoilers.
What happens next?
Okay. I mean, Jesus doesn't have a great deal to say about why the resurrection is so important.
Which is critically important to the resurrection.
It is critically important, but I'd say if you're looking at a film that was just going to say it just undermine the idea that the resurrection couldn't possibly have happened, this is the candidate for your job.
Okay. Risen opened nationally in cinemas last Thursday, and it's rated M for violence and some disturbing images. It does star Joseph Fiennes, Peter Firth, that kid from Harry Potter, and Cliff Curtis as Yeshua. That's right, they use the Jewish name for Jesus throughout the movie. It's a nice little touch there.
Look, if you're looking for more material like the sort of stuff that we're talking about today, you really should head over to thebigpicturewebsite.com. That's actually the URL, thebigpicturewebsite.com.
Best URL ever.
Yeah, okay, and it's so memorable. And you'll find there all our past shows. You'll find also videos and additional material and lots of articles and things that sort of build this up, including actually my review of Risen. So check that out and enjoy, you know, everything, thinking it through.
Please enjoy, and also enjoy what's coming up in the rest of the show when it arrives. And when it does arrive, my goodness, you're going to enjoy it, because we're going to be talking to a Downton diehard about this final season of the show. And also we're talking about Will Smith's latest film, Concussion, and I will reveal my personal choices for the best TV box sets ever.
G'day and welcome back to The Big Picture. Look, if you haven't been completely taken in by First Date so far, because that's Ben's favourite program now.
Undoubtedly, Mark, undoubtedly. You should watch it.
You will swoon. You're probably a more cultured viewer like myself, one who has been following the travails of Downton Abbey. Ever since 2010, we've been watching Lady Edith Crowley get together with the rest of the family, Violet Crowley and Robert Crowley and Lady Mary Crowley, in fact, all the Crowleys, really, who have been having their struggles and trials ever since that nasty Titanic went down and they had to have a new heir for the Georgian house, which they all occupied together. Well, six seasons have come and are almost gone. Six whole seasons, and we've come to that point in which we're actually about to launch into the new one this week, the final episodes. And I got to talk to Laura Bennett, who probably is more a tragic Downton Abbey fan than I am. And we basically discussed what there was to say about the new and final eclipse of this epic series. Laura, thanks very much for being part of the show. Let me ask you, what are your credentials as a Downton Abbey fan?
I am. Well, you know what? I have a long history of loving these kind of period dramas, Jane Austen and Downton Abbey, two absolute favourites.
Okay, so there you are. You're right there every week. You were the one sitting there going...
Once I could get it on like the sort of Netflix box set version, yes, okay. Like absolutely.
Okay, well look, what did you find about these? Why do they appeal to you? Before we get into the show itself, we're looking at the final season. Why do you think women love it?
I think it's because there's always something so romantic, something so engaging about particularly these period dramas. They just make life, even in the hard times, look beautiful and elegant. And they speak with a beautiful English accent that we all wish we had. Even if they're doing the most ridiculous of things, it somehow seems appealing and you feel like that's the kind of life I would love to be living.
Yes, I knew it was the frocks. Okay, so give us a hint of what's to come in season six.
Well, I'm definitely not going to give any spoilers, so don't freak out about that. But you kind of see characters that need to have their comeuppance come their way. It does. But then also there's some very tidy endings for characters that you've come to really love, really like, and you sort of hope that things turn out well.
They'll get boxed away nicely. Okay, were you disappointed?
In some ways, yes, because one of the challenges...
It has been six seasons, so it's very hard to sustain this the entire time.
Yeah, and coming into this sixth season, I really thought about that because I wondered how long are we going to be interested in the nice accents, the beautiful frocks, this big house, this big manor? How long is that going to sustain our attention? And I think even, obviously the writers were probably asking that, but the characters as well, because for each of them, they're coming to this point where life for the Grantham estate is looking like it's on the decline. Things have really shifted. We're now in 1924, 25 or so, and life just isn't how it was when they first started out. And there's this family that have lived their lives thinking, we don't have to live by the moral code of everyone else because we've got wealth. We can somehow cover up the things that we do that aren't necessarily the greatest. And that's very apparent in this season because particularly Lady Mary, Lady Edith, they've got a lot of water under the bridge, but they're still trying to somehow kind of cover up their moral dysfunction at times with their wealth and with the manipulation that you've seen so much through the series. But I will say there's a nice turnaround from one of those characters that a lot of longtime fans will appreciate.
Oh, that is good. Well, listen, let's talk about it in terms of a life lesson, because often when you see something over six seasons, you've got a chance to deliver like an epic morality tale. Is there something that pops out at the end and you think, wow, that's something I can take away after all that time in front of the TV?
I think the biggest thing after all those hours of investment and the amount of time you have truly spent is that you realize that these characters, for all their flaws, do have this longing to truly live a better life, to try and somehow impact the people around them, even if it's sometimes misguided and their approach isn't always right, they do just kind of want to feel like they have a place in the world, that they're valued, and all of us want that. And the thing that is, I guess, learned most apparently in this final season is how much of a role we play, each of us, in making sure the people around us feel their purpose. Because one of the characters particularly really struggles with who he is, what his role is he still of value in this massive home? And his character particularly really needs the assurance of his support group around him. And I think if anything can be taken away, that's a really great thing. How can we support our sort of peers' purpose?
Yeah, God doesn't get a huge amount of mentioning through Downton Abbey. He's more like the setting for some of the plots. Mm. But that said, you're saying there's duty involved, that people realise they're expected to do things.
Yeah, well, and there's this sense of, because of the time it's set in and obviously the way life was lived then, there's definitely a sense of duty to family, but to king and country. And in some ways you look back on it thinking, this is just not realistic. This isn't the way modern life is. And yet somehow we find a way to identify with it, because I think all of us feel a need to have something bigger that our allegiance ties to. And whether that's our family or whether that's a sense of God or whether that's country, it's all in there.
Laura, thanks very much. Giving me a preview of something I'm now going to race off and watch.
No worries. You go enjoy those frocks too.
I will.
Thanks for having me.
Well, now showing this week includes a great film that might be understated, Concussion. The Super Bowl was on the other week. Did you catch it? Probably not, because American football, gridiron, let's face it, isn't huge over here.
Not that big, no.
But we've probably just offended, you know, massive people who are
every
running.
Every gridiron fan around.
There's probably one fan you really wouldn't want to offend, actually. Your sport doesn't cover it. Oh, really? Okay. But Will Smith's new movie, Concussion, goes off-field to paint gridiron in a dramatic light. Based on a true story, Concussion focuses upon one man's quest to reveal the dangerous truth behind the sport, even when it means his own reputation, family, and life are threatened.
I am the wrong person to have discovered this.
If you don't speak for them, who will?
Repetitive head trauma chokes the brain. It turns you into someone else.
Tape, needles, Vicodin, Toradol, whatever it takes to keep them in the game. It's business.
Get me a meeting with the commissioner. They don't want to talk to you.
The NFL has known about the concussion issue for years.
Will Smith's played a whole bunch of different real-life characters, like Muhammad Ali and whatever the guy's name was in The Pursuit of Happiness. That was based on a true story. Okay. That guy, pursuing happiness.
Memorable.
This time around, he's playing a Nigerian-born coroner working in Pittsburgh in the early 2000s, Dr. Bennett Amalu, who, as that trailer kind of indicates, discovers something in the brain of a deceased gridiron player who played for the Pittsburgh team. And what he discovers, and my medical jargon isn't great, but what he discovers is a condition called CTE, and then proceeds across the rest of the movie to try to get the attention of the NFL, to get them to recognize this as an actual condition caused by head trauma that's linked to concussion and a lot of early deaths, premature deaths of gridiron players. In and around Will Smith, he's surrounded by bigger, older actors like Alec Baldwin and Albert Brooks as different doctors caught up in this web. And it basically boils down to a movie similar to The Insider, that film with Russell Crowe and Al Pacino years ago, where one man, a whistleblower, went up against a giant corporation. It becomes that kind of story. So it's not so much gridiron, Mark.
Yeah, it sounds more like a David and Goliath story.
Yeah, it is. Look, Will Smith is good in this. A lot of this movie is good, but it's not amazing. It's not as inspiring as you expect it to be. It's not
Really? I was really looking forward to the next big Will Smith performance piece.
Yeah,
it doesn't measure up?
It does. It does. I don't think he's doing it. He doesn't do a terrible job at all. Dr. Bennett Amalu is an interesting dude in the way that he goes about his job and his sort of everything from his sense of humor to his approach to his job doesn't necessarily work as well on screen as it might. So he's not instantly the kind of character that you warm to, even though he's a pretty affable guy. And so Will Smith plays him very, very well. But the movie suffers a little bit from being a bit stiff and serious. It's well intended, but it's almost too serious for its own good, which is difficult to say given the subject matter and given what it's about. But it's almost like that you can feel the air being sucked out of the room, because there's characters are saying things that are really profound and meaningful, almost in their everyday speech. And people don't speak like that. People don't give a speech every time they talk, and that tends to happen a bit in Concussion. as the story goes along and as it plays out. And similar to Steve Jobs that's on screens around the place, there's a bit of a remix of truth going on screen. I don't think as much as Steve Jobs, but Steve Jobs was heading to be much more of a portrait of Steve Jobs, an impression of Steve Jobs, as opposed to the out-and-out truth. I think this film, you'd be expecting more truth from it. But if you go and hunt down online articles about Dr. Bennett Omalu, you'll find that some of the everything from the time frame to some of the allegations made against Omalu and also against the NFL aren't as they're depicted
as
on screen.
As they should
There's a lot of grains of truth. I'm not saying it's falsifying, but it's not as true as it depicts on screen.
So I take it his great epic speeches about the American dream were probably somewhat inserted. Did you take much away from that?
Mate, there's a lot of talk in this movie about what it is to be an American, wanting to be an American. Bennett Omalu, before he moved to America, according to this film and according to interviews that I've seen with him, he in the film he describes when he was a kid thinking that heaven was kind of up here, like making this indication like a level, and then just under that level was America. And what America is basically the country where people would live, where the people that God wanted people to be, that's what America, that's who's there, that's the best version of you is going on in there. So there's a lot of contrast going on between the way America can appear and the way that country, that nation can present itself and its people, and everything from the way people carry themselves to the jobs they do and the way they interact is all woven through Concussion. And in contrast, an outsider, Dr. Omalu, comes in, an outsider to the country, an outsider to the NFL, and sort of shines a light, puts a mirror up to exactly how things are. And he becomes a bit disillusioned as he goes along. But it's not necessarily a sacking of the American dream, this movie, but it's a strong undercurrent going in this, particularly when you get the contrast between big business at the cost of human lives in the NFL.
Now, I like how you actually sort of wove in that reference to God there, because I take it Dr. Omalu is referencing Christianity or referencing God.
Mate, he
through
does way more than expected. I don't know how much you know about this guy. I didn't know much. And I went and looked after seeing Concussion, because I was quite struck by how many times God shows up in this film, which is great for a show like The Big Picture, where we talk about a Christian perspective on movies and TV. This is a freebie, because constantly through Concussion, you get everything from crucifixes hanging on walls to Dr. Omalu going to church to him praying silently and out loud. He gets a lady staying in his house as like a housemate who eventually becomes his wife. And there's a little bit suspect about their relationship in one point in the film, but it's not too dodgy. Otherwise, he's pretty gentlemanly. But she says grace and she thanks God for gifts. And then throughout the film, Omalu says stuff like, God didn't intend us to play gridiron, and then sign to say, take God out of it. And then towards the end of this big speech that he gives, he talks about redemption and forgiveness and finding peace and all this kind of stuff. Even a priest earlier in the movie says to Dr. Omalu, I see God working in you, which is great. What I was a little bit disappointed in, similar to when we were talking about Brooklyn on the show last week, the film isn't Christian. Brooklyn's not Christian. Concussion is that they're not trying to present Christian messages like Risen is. So you can't expect too much from the characters in it. But it would have been excellent to have a little bit more, like you're saying about Risen, a little
clearly
bit.
There's a sense of something in his character in that.
And yeah, and I think what they've done is backed off a bit in Concussion, yeah, but they also want to bring it in. So you get this tension of like, we want to mention this guy's a Christian and he really strongly believes that God's put him in this position to speak out, which is a very prominent thing in Christian teaching about speaking up for truth, even in the face of persecution. So that's fantastic. They want to get that in Concussion, but not really sure about how far to go. And yet it's constantly in there. So I came out a little bit bewildered about the presentation of this Christian man and what drove him. Mm. And I think it'd be better to go and read books or articles about it to get the full picture of what's going on with Dr. Omalu and when he went up against the NFL.
Okay, well, Concussion stars Will Smith, Alec Baldwin and Albert Brooks. It opened at cinemas last Thursday, February 18, and is rated M for mature themes and coarse language.
Mate, still to come on the show, what's the one TV box set that a reviewer would take to a desert island? Great question, and we're going to answer that very soon. And then I'm going to reveal my personal top 5 TV box sets of all time.
Welcome back. Listen, if you've been enjoying what you're hearing, you know you're only hearing a bit of it. I mean, the truth is, we actually record lots more material in our special features section of the podcast. If you actually go
with voices like that, special features,
the bigpicturewebsite.com, check that out. You'll actually find the podcast section, and you'll find much more rich and involved material there for you to actually indulge in as well. If you love the show, you'll love the podcast even more.
Check it out. And now check out the vault segment this week. If any of us were stranded on a desert island, the first thing we would think about, Mark, is what's the one TV show I wished I brought with me?
That's what I would have done.
That, of course, that's what you would have done. Okay, that might not be the first thing
water.
You think of. What am I going to eat? But isn't
no,
it,
eat.
However, it is an incredibly important survival question.
For what am I watching on telly tonight?
And you also got to have a way to play the show and
yeah, electricity, okay. Blah, blah, blah.
But with all those factors in mind, it's a great question to ask. For our Vault segment this week, we asked two of Insights Magazine's reviewers, Adrian and Toya, to go back through their own personal vaults and tell us all what their ultimate desert island TV viewing would be.
I picked Game of Thrones.
Whoa,
for my
Toya, box Game of Thrones.
I know it's not for everyone and it's quite the controversial series, but I still think that it has a lot of merit as a box set to take away on a desert island with you.
Okay, I'll come back to Game of Thrones. Adrian, are you taking Game of Thrones to a desert island or are you taking something else?
No, I'd have to take my box set, which is probably, you know, 60 VHSs of X-Files.
Adrian, old school. So you're not talking about the new, is it a 6-part series?
No, there is a new 6-part series, but the original series aired for 9 seasons from 1993.
Whoa, so, like way back in the day.
Way back in the day. Even before the internet.
Well, so you see, you'd have to pack up your VHS and your 60 VHS catalog. What was the impact the show had on you, Adrian?
Well, as a young bloke, maybe not too
younger.
It was a really interesting series because it delved into the supernatural and starred David Duchovny as Fox Mulder and Gillian Anderson as Dana Scully, who were FBI agents, and they basically were into discovering anything related to the governmental conspiracy theories, you know, Area 51. And it was kind of a series that you couldn't really peg because from week to week it was either a thriller or a supernatural did all sorts of things. And it was really a bit of a groundbreaking TV show in that running for 9 seasons. And back then, 23 episodes per season.
Wow.
They were able to sustain a lot of interest.
Yeah.
And it's become a bit of a pop culture phenomenon.
Now, guys, I'm impressed that you were able to narrow down your choice to one box set. If you're on a desert island and you actually happen to have the ability to play a TV show, why would you bring Game of Thrones with you?
Okay, so I picked Game of Thrones because it kind of has a bit of everything, like what Adrian was saying about X-Files, but in a different way. So it's also it's a fairly longish series, nothing like X-Files. It's 6 seasons and only about 11 or 12 episodes per season, but it's still fairly long enough to kind of like watch and distract yourself from being stuck on a desert island. Also, it has kind of everything. It has love and romance, it has war, it has magic, it has politics, it has death, it has some comedy as well. It kind of has everything you would kind of look for, I guess, rather than just bringing, say, my other box set that I was thinking about was Breaking Bad, which doesn't really have all of that stuff. It has a narrower focus, whereas Game of Thrones, you can kind of get a little bit of everything in it.
Wow, so you'd be living out a fantasy life on the desert island through the fantasy world, the controversial fantasy world of Game of Thrones. What about you, Adrian? Why go X-Files?
Well, I think the tantalizing thing for me about X-Files is the tagline, which everybody would know, was the truth is out there. Everybody wants to know where the truth is. You know, where does the truth lie? So it was a really fascinating series from that point of view. I think maybe if I took it on a desert island with me, it'd scare me a bit because there are a few scary episodes. But, you know, you always need a few jolts.
Without giving the whole show away, Adrian, do they find the truth?
They still haven't, no.
Wow. No,
they're still out there somewhere.
They're still out there, so which is why they've got the 6 episodes that they're doing this year. In fact, they are airing now, so on Channel 10.
Awesome. Thank you very much, Toya and Adrian, for joining us. A very personal vault session, and I promise the big picture is not banishing you to a desert island.
Thank you, Ben. Good to know. Later.
Yeah, Mark, I was not only impressed that Toya and Adrian were able to limit their choice down to one, but that Toya picked Game of Thrones, which we should put in a big warning to listeners about. If you aren't already warned about the show already, definitely not for everyone.
Don't be rushing out and say, oh, that'll be a good one for grandma.
It is rated R. And as Toya said, there is everything, a bit of everything in it.
Possibly a bit too much of everything.
You just might be completely startled by the everything that's
that Adrian Drayton guy, though, he's pretty smart because VHS players handle sand much better than DVD players.
And you can read more of Adrian and Toya's stuff over at the Insights website, insights.uca.org.au. They cover the latest films and movies out on DVD and Blu-ray. A little bit like us,
yes.
Mark. A little bit like us.
Yes.
that's all you got?
With fewer ironic T-shirts.
What about you, Mark? What's the one TV show that you would take to a desert island?
I can't believe that people don't realise how many VHS cassettes are involved in Star Trek The Next Generation.
Yeah, I just can't possibly
all
fathom.
All six seasons. Well, you could build a shelter.
So are you saying that Star Trek's Next Generation, the VHS collection, is what you would take?
Yes, because you could actually build a windbreak. You could probably build an entire secure harbour out of those.
Pragmatic and living in the future. I have the great pleasure this week of doing a personal top five list around my ultimate choices of box sets. I will say that this list doesn't exactly represent all of my tastes in TV. I've thought through, I tried to get a selection. I've tried to think about who could be listening and what I could recommend
enough
to people.
Enough prevaricating. You're just trying to get away from the embarrassment.
And but what I also want to point out is I'm glad it's not you doing this list because it would just be populated by science fiction shows all the way through.
And the occasional Western.
And I have none. I have no science fiction shows.
Five.
2008 series In Treatment. Mark, it's got 43 episodes.
Have you started?
What?
In Treatment?
In Treatment. Yeah, hear me out. So HBO, which has been largely responsible for revolutionizing TV in the last two decades or so, and plenty of other companies have got on board the bandwagon, AMC and Netflix and that kind of thing. But HBO, with shows like The Sopranos and The West Wing and that kind of thing, really took off TV. In Treatment, plenty of shows are about relationships and the difficulties, particularly the difficulties that people get into, whether they're gangsters or whether it's in a Western setting or science fiction or whatever. In Treatment, though, which has got 43 episodes in the first season, is us sitting in the room with a psychologist played by Gabriel Byrne, and he has different patients every day of the week. And so each episode is like a Monday, then a Tuesday, then Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, and repeats back around, which is why it's got 43 episodes.
So you come back around to Tuesday guy.
That's exactly right. And you spend half an hour with these people as they go through their issues. And it's fantastic. I can't believe you're laughing at this. It's absorbing television. Have you seen it?
I've got enough problems of my own. Why would I want to watch somebody else's? Okay. No, that's great. Go.
Because you get to watch intimate and painful and awkward observations of people at various stages of healing and restoring and breakdown and all kinds of things, which can remind you of your own life. Sure.
It did sound a lot like my family.
But it often can, I think, help you try to get out of that situation, or at least feel better about yourself because you're not these people, including Gabriel Byrne as the psychologist who just does a terrible job of helping himself out as he tries to help other people. Mate, you shouldn't snicker In Treatment.
I won't.
Deserves your respect.
I won't. I like from Gabriel Byrne.
From 2008. All right, I'll see how you go with this one.
Four.
The Office, but the American one.
Oh, thank you.
The Office, but the American one. You don't like the English?
I don't like the English one because it's too painful.
It is very painful, the English original. For anyone who doesn't know what we're talking about, the BBC comedy series from, was it like the early 2000s, that Ricky Gervais in, that shot him to stardom, about what goes on in the minor everyday situations of an office. And then it was transplanted to America in 2005. And for many people, including myself, who liked the original show a lot, it took me a long time to actually watch the American remake that Steve Carell stars in. And then after about the first six episodes of The Office, the American one, it becomes a much different beast than its own show. It's very similar. It's like it's got even similar episodes that are almost completely knocked off from the original. But because the original ran shorter, and also because it's now set in America, there's a big difference in the American one than with the English. And that's why it makes number four on my list. It's very rewatchable, more rewatchable than the original, I think. Mainly because it's not as caustic, abrasive, and abusive.
Mm.
It's definitely got that. It's often that comedy of insulting people and mocking people and laughing people, which I struggle with personally because I find that stuff very funny. And yet I think in The Office, they have dialed it back somewhat in the American one. And there's a greater sense of rapport among the people in The Office. office situation. And as the series goes along too, you get to know more about the bit characters, the side characters in this. It's not just focused on the lead, the manager in the office. But Steve Carell is fantastic as Michael Scott in this show. If you haven't watched it, check it out. I actually haven't got past season 7. So if I was going to get the whole box set, I'd actually have some new episodes to watch because I haven't been watching since Michael Scott, since Steve Carell left.
There's a hint for a Christmas present.
Exactly right.
I heard one. 3.
I was going through my personal vault, the archives, the mental archives, thinking about what show kind of represents me at various times in my life. I could have picked something like Seinfeld. That was massive for me at a particular time. But around the time, The Simpsons was a much bigger, much more shaped my life for some period of time there. That started in 1989, The Simpsons, and it continues to go on. I think it's up to season 28 now. But I bowed out somewhere around season 12, 13.
Did turn 28.
But I remember being at university, sitting around at lunchtimes with a bunch of mates, and we didn't talk about the journalism subjects that we were studying. We talked about the Simpsons episode we watched the night before and proceeded to say as many lines and reproduce as many situations as we could. Well, not act them out, but like talk about them. And Simpsons quotes were just like ruled my 20s. They still continue to pop up from time to time now. But those early ones, I want to repeat those early episodes.
And yet he still got married.
That's right. You can still get married even by being a Simpsons fan. But for a show that was an amazing pop culture blender before, everything from The Family Guy, Futurama, Community, Big Bang Theory, all jumped on the bandwagon later. Yeah. The Simpsons was a great parody of a parody of a parody of a parody that was so good at tearing society apart while also raising it back up. Mm. It's a bit of a shame that it kind of lost itself along the way. But those early episodes is why it ranks at number 3 on my personal list of top box sets. 2. Oh, I had had some issues here, Mark.
Because we've had a bit of psychological drama. We've had a bit of comedy. And now we've got
Twin Peaks.
Yikes.
Yeah, Twin Peaks. And I was thinking about putting it number 1.
I was thinking about going
number 1 because name for me another show like Twin Peaks that's ever been able to capture as a TV show what Twin Peaks was.
Well, it was criminalized. That's why there's not another one.
Criminalized? What are you talking about?
Okay, go ahead.
Mate, for anyone who hasn't seen it, the David Lynch show that was out in the late 80s and early 90s, which before marketing campaigns really, really took off for TV shows, it did a great job on promoting itself with T-shirts and this whole Who Killed Laura Palmer campaign that went along with Twin Peaks, which was massive. Even if you didn't see the show, it was all around at the time. And the basic thread of Twin Peaks is effectively a murder mystery about who killed a teenager in a small town. But for anyone who's seen any David Lynch stuff, you get the dark, odd underbelly of postcard America raised for you on screen in the weird and wonderful weekly existence of David Lynch's mind up on screen.
But if you want a mystery that's actually going to make sense.
Well, it may or may not make sense. And one of the downsides of it actually is the mystery got solved halfway through the second series. And so the rest of it isn't worth watching because it was great to like work out what's going on here. And Twin Peaks is coming back. There's a prequel coming back to TV in the next couple of years, which I'm really looking forward to. But I picked it because before Sopranos, West Wing, all those kind of things, this show I think revolutionized the way TV was put together and could actually demonstrate that you could do something like kind of out of your mind on TV, but yet make sophisticated stuff. But it didn't make it to number 1.
I'm anticipating. 1. Your best box set?
As we've mentioned, Mark, all the way through this, you get all these honorable mentions on this kind of list, don't you? Because you go through the stuff that you really like. So honorable mentions for me are things like The Sopranos, Breaking Bad, True Detective, Mad Men. I haven't seen Game of Thrones, so I'm not going to put that on there. But The Wire.
Yes.
But you finally agree with me at number 1, The Wire.
Yes, I do. I mean, look, you know, The West Wing maybe, but The Wire is epic.
The Wire, I think, for me, summarizes what's so great about TV in the last couple of decades that you can. It's a 5-series show and set in Baltimore, and from the surface, it looks like a cop and drug drama of cops trying to take down drug dealers. But across the 5 seasons, it goes through pretty much every level of society to present to us almost the corrupted heart of the American dream up on screen.
And we should say, because that it is MA 15+.
It definitely is.
Because
it
is delving into the underbelly. So be aware. But this is brilliant.
So massive word of warning. There's a lot of language, violence, intense situations here. I don't think you could have depicted this any other way. But what I found most amazing about it is a lot of other shows seem to rely on stars and characters to drive the thing forward. I think The Wire, everyone in it from the small to the big is driving the show forward. And the show is so much just focused on the decay of Western civilization and why corruption undermines the social pillars around us. When it's allowed to thrive, it will undermine social
and
pillars.
And perspective, look, from a writing perspective, it was incredible because the first series was about the police and the drugs, but the second series was about the educational system, and the third series that we start to look at the politicians. It's just brilliant.
Mate, I'm so with you. So that's why The Wire comes in at number one for me. If you want a portrait of how corrupted our hearts can be at every kind of level, from kids right through to adults in all sorts of different positions of power as well, and how if you don't use power for good, if you just use it for self-serving gains, and if you have demonstrate terrible leadership across an entire society, this is what can happen to you. It's not a very chipper note to end on, but The Wire is definitely my number one box set.
If you haven't seen it,
y'all don't know how to play chess, do you?
You sure?
See this the kingpin, he the man.
I like your uncle.
You get the other dude's king, you got the game. It's the queen. She fierce. She move any way she want. She got all the moves.
Remind me of Stringer.
These are the pawns. They like the soldiers. In the game, they get capped quick.
So how do you get to be the king?
See, the king, stay the king.
Yeah, so another big word of warning about The Wire. If you're going to go and check it out, proceed cautiously. It is rated MA 15+, but it's a fantastic TV drama.
Well, we've given you great films to watch. There's huge amounts of television now at your disposal. Next week, our Oscar show featuring my best Academy Award soundtrack. Mix up another one, Ben.
Oh, mate, and we're also going to talk about what our one or two Oscar movies that we think are the best around at the moment.
My worst crimes ever committed by Oscar. And of course, our predictions for this year's winners. Do they match yours? You'll find out.
I won't be Oscar then. I'll be Ben McKechnie.
And I'm still Mark Hadley. Thanks for being with us.
The Big Picture is a Bible Society Australia production, sharing the light of God's word into every corner of your world.